second book of Samuel, chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron. "Look," they said, "we are your own flesh and blood. In days past, when Saul was our king, it was you who led Israel in all their exploits. And the Lord said to you, 'You are the man who shall be shepherd of my people Israel. You shall be the leader of Israel.'" So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. And King David made a pact with them at Hebron in the presence of the Lord, and they anointed David king of Israel. Our second reading is from the letter of St. Paul to the Colossians, chapter 1, verses 11 to 20. "You will have in you the strength, based on his own glorious power, never to give in, but to bear anything joyfully, thanking the Father who has made it possible for you to join the saints, and with them to inherit the light. Because that is what he has done. He has taken us out of the power of darkness and created a place for us in the kingdom of the Son that he loves. And in him we gain our freedom, the forgiveness of our sins. He is the image of the unseen God and the firstborn of all creation. For in him were created all things in heaven and on earth, everything visible and everything invisible, thrones, dominations, sovereignties, powers. All things were created through him and for him. Before anything was created, he existed, and he holds all things in unity. Now the church is his body, he is its head. As he is the beginning, he was first to be born from the dead, so that he should be first in every way. Because God wanted all perfection to be found in him, and all things to be reconciled through him and for him. Everything in heaven and everything on earth, when he made peace by his death on the cross. And our third and final reading, the Gospel reading, is from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 23, verses 35 to 43. The people stayed there watching Jesus. As for the leaders, they jeered at him. "He saved others," they said, "let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, the Chosen One." The soldiers mocked him too, and when they approached to offer him vinegar, they said, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." Above him there was an inscription, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals hanging there abused him. "Are you not the Christ?" he said. "Save yourself and us as well." But the other spoke up and rebuked him. "Have you no fear of God at all?" he said. "You got the same sentence as he did, but in our case, we deserved it. We are paying for what we did, for this man has done nothing wrong." "Jesus," he said, "remember me when you come into your kingdom." "Indeed, I promise you," he replied, "today you will be with me in paradise." And now to our reflection for the feast of Christ, Universal King. In relation to our Old Testament reading, the Hebrew Bible, it's interesting to note that according to ancient Near Eastern thought, the wider context of Israel, for example, the Sumerian king list from over in Mesopotamia, kingship was lowered from heaven, and so was part of the very structure of creation. Hence, it couldn't be tampered with. And you can see something of this in the notion of the divine right of kings in European tradition. Interestingly, the Old Testament takes a different line, or one should probably say more accurately, different lines. It contains texts that portray monarchy arising as a result of the demand of the people and God's reluctant permission, for example, 1 Samuel 8. And this same chapter even has a verse that claims an Israelite king is a rejection of God as king. In contrast to this, the next chapter, 1 Samuel 9, has Saul anointed king by the prophet Samuel to deliver Israel from Philistine oppression. Here, God takes the initiative. And in Deuteronomy chapter 17, Israel is allowed to have a king if it so desires. But the text forbids him to behave in any way like the nations. In this text, monarchy is seen as an option. The Old Testament also describes other forms of leadership. For example, the judge, the prophet, the priest, the elders of a town. What is striking about all of these, including monarchy, is that the Bible never condemns the particular institution as institutional, or claims that one institution provides a better form of leadership than another. What it does, however, is praise or condemn judges, prophets, priests, kings, and, of course, the people. The message seems to be that the problem lies not in your systems, but in yourselves. So there is no magic system that will work willy-nilly. For the Bible, it all depends on the people involved and their loyalty to God and to one another. In our first reading for our feast, we have an account of the negotiations between David and the tribes of Israel for him to become king, after he had reigned for a time over the southern state of Judah. The people acknowledged God's choice of David, and for a time David delivered the goods. According to the story of David, and this is about all we have, he forged a united kingdom, gained victory over enemies, established peace and prosperity. But the story also exposes the other side of David. He's portrayed as a rapist, a murderer, a bad father, and according to one of Saul's descendants, Shimei, in 2 Samuel chapter 16, a man of blood. Perhaps the famous saying that power corrupts seems to fit the latter part of David's life and that of his son Solomon pretty well. According to 1 Kings chapter 9 and 11, Solomon's sins commenced Israel's long downward slide to the exile. And slide that was slowed temporarily only by a few reforming kings. In time, kingship in Israel came to look more and more like its neighbours. Israel became like the nations. No wonder prophets began looking for an anointed one, a Messiah, who would, in God's good time, bring justice and peace to Israel. They believed that the answer did not lie in a new system of government, but in a person. We Christians believe that Jesus is that person, the hoped-for Messiah. In keeping with Old Testament categories of expression, the New Testament speaks of Jesus as a king, but it then goes on to turn the tables on the customary understanding of what a king is or should do. Jesus does not come to establish a system of government or a dynasty. Rather, he comes to establish a community in which justice, love, and peace rule. Moreover, Jesus transforms what must have been the ugliest, most unlikely royal court ever seen on earth, that is, his trial and crucifixion, into something beautiful, noble, and desirable. And so we venerate the crucifix. He rules from a tree as a convicted criminal, and from this throne invites others to share fully in his kingdom, as he says to the thief, "This day you will be with me in paradise." Kings, as we know from our history, are more often than not engaged in violent conquest or obliged to counter violence with violence. It is as if a society becomes enslaved to violence. Instead, Jesus brings peace to a violent world and frees it from enslavement to violence by forgiving the violent and loving them even unto death. In relation to this portrait of Jesus as King, it's instructive for us to note the movement of thought in the reading from Colossians, our second reading for the feast. Here, Paul proclaims that God has taken us out of the power of darkness and created for us a place in the kingdom of the Son that he loves. But Paul's description of the relationship between king and subjects in this kingdom again rewrites the customary notions of monarchy. According to the hymn in Colossians, Christ is the head and the church community is his body. It would be pretty hard to find a more intimate and powerful expression of personal union than this Colossians hymn.